This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tonight, President Bush makes the first in a series of speeches designed to counteract the gathering impression that his policy in Iraq is badly adrift. From the failure to find weapons of mass destruction to the scandal at Abu Ghraib, many wonder anew if the invasion and occupation justifies the cost. With 37 days to go before the scheduled transfer of power in Baghdad, basic questions about the powers of an interim Iraqi government remain unanswered. The president and prime minister have yet to be named, and it's not at all yet clear that Iraqis will perceive any difference after June 30th. American commanders warn that Iraq could grow more violent after the handover. This, some policy experts and analysts say, is the time for resolve. More American troops, they argue, will help stabilize the situation. Others say it's time to reassess the American commitment and set a timetable for withdrawal. For most of this hour, we'll talk about the deepening sense of crisis and the administration's response in what may prove to be a critical week for diplomacy and for salesmanship. And we focus today on the issue of troops. Is it time to escalate up or down? If you have questions about the merits of more troops in Iraq, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is NPR Pentagon correspondent Eric Westervelt. He's back in Iraq. Good evening, Eric, there in Baghdad.
Good evening, Neil.
Before we go on to the subject of troops, I have to ask you about a video that's been playing on some television outlets today that appears to provide a lot of justification for one version of the story about an incident that happened in western Iraq last week where Iraqi civilians say American helicopters attacked a wedding party.
That's right. The attack was last Wednesday in western Iraq near the Syrian border. And for days, the U.S. military has said that they continue to believe that this attack was on a kind of a safe house for foreign fighters, a place that foreign fighters coming in from Syria would stay, get change of clothes into Iraqi gear and Iraqi clothes, perhaps get a fake ID, etc. And they've this past weekend, Brigadier General Mark Kimmett showed some slides from that strike area, Neil, that he said bolsters that argument. But in the last 24 hours, more video obtained by the Associated Press Television News has shown a video of a wedding party that matches some of the video of people who are being buried after the strike. So it appears that the video, in some cases, bolsters the argument that this was, in fact, a wedding strike. But U.S. officials I've spoken with said there are still some inconsistencies in the video, and it's not independently we're not independently able to verify, you know, the source of this video, Neil, or its authenticity.
Well, moving on now to the subject of troops, which we're going to be discussing most of this hour. Here in Washington last week, General Abizaid said he may well need more troops. Is that what you're expecting to hear from the president tonight?
Well, I think so. I mean, let's remember that the 1st Armored Division and the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment were literally, you know, on their way home, Neil, when General John Abizaid, the head of U.S. Central Command, ordered them to stay for an extra 3 to 4 months to help handle the, you know, deteriorating security situation here and uprisings in Fallujah, in the Sunni hotbed of Fallujah west of Baghdad, as well as an uprising by Muqtada al-Sadr, radical Shiite cleric in the Najaf, Karbala, Kufa area south of Baghdad. And those troops, you know, have been incredibly busy in the last 6 weeks. And I think it's expected that General Abizaid will ask for additional troops in coming weeks.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been in Iraq back there for a few weeks now. What are you hearing from soldiers and Marines there about whether or not they think they would be helped by having more boots on the ground?
Well, I mean, from soldiers I've talked with, Neil, there are some sharply different opinions. I mean, it's pretty universal among people I've talked with that they'd like shorter tours of duty in Iraq, say 6 months instead of 12 months. But in terms of actual numbers, and to answer your question, some young lieutenants and captains and some senior officers have argued pretty strongly that it's more important the type of soldier you deploy, Neil, how you deploy them, and the tactics and procedures on the ground, not the gross number. I mean, remember, this is, counterinsurgency. It's a difficult, tricky task. It's intelligence-centered. And to get that, you know, good human intelligence, they need, a specialized type of soldier and some cooperation with local people, you know, and that has more to do, they say, with tactics than raw numbers. That said, you know, some soldiers I've chatted with have said they think the key is another division or two in here to just flood the area, root out the insurgents, and expedite a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how much our troops, even officers, able to have time to think about wider strategy, and how much time are they just thinking about their tactical role today?
Well, I think a lot of the grunts on the ground at the platoon and other levels are certainly focused on their day-to-day tasks. When they get this, their fragos, as they call it, their fragmentary orders, they're very focused on mm-hmm. how to carry that out the following day. The specifics, that might be intelligence gathering, it might be a security operation, it might be protecting a convoy, it might be a raid, working on some kind of actionable intelligence they've gotten. So they're very focused on that. I think officers, though, at the major and above are taking a step back and looking a lot and talking among themselves about what the best strategy is and whether more troops really would do that or whether that would just create more targets and what the best bigger strategy really is.
What is morale like from what you can tell?
Well, I think it's mixed, Neil. Depends on where you are. I mean, up in the north, there are fewer attacks by insurgents. The Iraqi Civil Defense Corps and police units, generally speaking, have kind of had better success in sticking around. There have been more success stories up there. Other parts, certainly in Baghdad and in southern parts of the country, the fighting is more intense, and soldiers are tired. I mean, certainly the 1st Armored Division is doing a lot of heavy lifting and continues to. I mean, they were in Baghdad for 12 months and then got shifted southward to help put down an intense uprising by Muqtada al-Sadr. So certainly, they're tired, but they continue to focus on their mission. I think morale suffered some among some units, but, many soldiers I've talked with have said, as long as I know exactly how long I'm going to be here, which is often 12 months, they can focus better and know that once those 12 months are over, they're out of here. But in the case of the 1st Armored Division, Neil, that's going to be a good 3 months longer than 12.
Yeah. I wonder, what are you hearing from Iraqis about whether they think more troops would help to stabilize the situation there, make them safer, or whether it's whether they want the U.S. to pull out now?
Well, it's a bit of a paradox. I mean, you talk to Iraqis, they're angry at the occupation, they want U.S. forces out, they say they want sovereignty, but they also desperately want increased security. I mean, daily there are roadside bombs and attacks with RPGs and small arms fire and other firefights. They want security, not just from the an end of the roadside bombs, but also from kidnappings and thievery and other crimes that are going on throughout the country. And they want Americans to provide that. So on the one hand, they want us out. And on the other hand, they say the U.S. should do more to provide security. And when you really press Iraqis in conversation and say, look, if the 140,000 U.S. troops on the ground pulled out right now, what do you think would happen? Many of them say, oh, no, they can't do that. There would be a civil war here. So it's a bit of a paradox.
Mm. Eric Westervelt, thanks very much. And I understand it's your birthday.
It is.
Happy birthday, Eric.
Thanks, Neil. Pleasure to be here.
Eric Westervelt, NPR's Pentagon correspondent, joining us today on the satellite telephone from Baghdad. The central question for today's discussion is whether or not the U.S. send more troops, as General Abizaid has asked, what effect the proposed increase would have, and what other options are if more troops are not the answer. Joining us here in Studio 3A are two guests, Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower, Reserve Affairs, Installations, and Logistics in the Reagan administration. Good to have you on the program.
Nice again to be with you, Neil.
And Charles Pena is the Director of Defense Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and thanks for you to coming in.
Thank you.
Larry Korb, let's start with you. Do you think we should send in more troops?
I think we should, but as Eric pointed out, that's necessary, but it's not sufficient to achieve our objectives. But the fact of the matter is we never had enough troops in there to provide security throughout the country, which you need if you're going to have any type of rebuilding. You've never had enough troops to guard the borders, which is why we had this horrible incident last week where we thought we went after this safe house. And of course, by not guarding the borders, you've let a lot of foreign fighters come in. I think the generals were sort of cowered by Secretary Rumsfeld not to ask for as many troops after they saw what happened to General Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff, who said you'd need several hundred thousand after the fall of Saddam. And he was, put out of, not only did he have to leave office, they didn't even go to his retirement party. So I think we do need more troops. The question really is, do they have to be Americans? What kind, and where are they going to come from? But mm-hmm. you got to get that security situation under control.
Mm-hmm. Chuck Pena, your opinion?
Well, I think analytically, if you look at it, yes, you need more troops. The situation is not good. If you look at the British example in Northern Ireland, you needed roughly 10 troops per 1,000 civilians to have something like law and order that translates in Iraq to 250,000 troops. So clearly, from that perspective, if you look at it analytically, we don't have enough. On the other hand, I think sending more troops is exactly the wrong thing to do. I mean, the polls before the uprisings in Fallujah, Najaf, the Abu Ghraib revelations showed that some 60% of Iraqis wanted American troops to leave immediately. I've been hearing recent polls as high as the high 80 percentage points of Iraqis want American troops to leave. I think we need to take those Iraqi sentiments very seriously. We do not want to be an occupying force. If we send more troops in, we will become exactly what insurgents inside Iraq want, exactly what the terrorists want. This is serious because, in my opinion, what we're doing is we're actually endangering American lives here in the United States because we are creating more reasons for not just Arabs in the Middle East, but throughout the Muslim world, to hate the United States because of our policies, because of our actions. And that is simply the first step towards sympathizing with the al-Qaeda and other Islamic extremist terrorists and becoming terrorists themselves.
Larry Korb, are the problems that we've encountered in Iraq, are those problems of planning or just simply not enough troop numbers? You've been very critical of what's been going on.
Well, I think the post-war or the post-major combat phase has been bungled right from the beginning. Not only did you not have enough troops on the ground to provide security, they did not give the troops any instructions about what to do when the looting broke out. General Gardner, who was going to be in charge of the post-war phase of handling the situation.
Jay Gardner, yeah.
Yes, General Jay Gardner, who he went in and he was told that we'd be greeted as liberators. We could keep the Ba'athist army and security forces or the Iraqi army and security forces intact. And he was relieved, and they brought in Ambassador Bremer, Jerry Bremer. When I was over there in Iraq, the thing that amazed me, I couldn't figure out who was in charge. Was it Bremer? Was it Abizaid? And they had different organizational structures. Bremer had organized the country one way. The military had organized it another way. So I think right from the beginning, this thing was horribly planned. And the question becomes now, how do we deal with this situation we've got where I think Chuck is right. By going in there and the way we handle it, we have made ourselves less secure, but we are where we are, and the question is, what do we do now?
And Chuck, you say more troops aren't the answer. Are fewer troops the answer? Is it time to pull out?
I think the answer is that we've got to hand over sovereignty, even in some limited form, at the end of June. We have to meet that deadline because otherwise we will be seen as not being true to our word by the Iraqi people. And then I think we need to set a date certain for military withdrawal. Now, for those people that are talking about exit strategy, you'll get a wide range of how long we should stay in Iraq. Personally, I think that we should be out by the end of January 2005. That's a very quick withdrawal, but doable. I think it needs to be orderly, and I think it needs to be on our terms. That's the most important thing. I think we need to leave Iraq as quickly as possible on our terms rather than having forced withdrawal in, say, 12 months, 24 months, however long it might be, where it can only be interpreted as a defeat for the United States.
And that would be right after the elections right. for a new Iraqi government. We're going to come back and talk more about whether or not more troops in Iraq is the best strategic, operational, or tactical move for the U.S. military. And we'll take your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send email, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow we'll talk about what the president says in tonight's address at the Army War College, the first of several speeches he's to make on U.S. policy in Iraq. Today we're discussing the possibility of sending more troops to Iraq, how that could affect strategy, and what the alternatives could be. You're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests here in Studio 3A are Lawrence Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information, and Charles Pena, director of defense policy studies at the Cato Institute. And let's get some callers on the line. Robert is with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi.
Hi.
And happy birthday, Eric.
Okay, we'll pass it on to Eric.
Okay. Listen, a couple quotes come to mind when listening to you guys talk, and one of them is, I think Edmund Burke said that people generally get the kind of government they deserve. And the other is a quote from David Thoreau: if I heard someone was coming to my house to do me some good, I would run for my life. And how that pertains to this situation. I mean, as you're talking, you know, you're talking about a double bind situation where the Iraqis are saying, give us this, give us that, we don't have any infrastructure, you know, hook up the electricity, provide security, but don't be here. They have to come up to the plate. I had a moment of truth during the Vietnam War. I served two tours over there. My second tour during the Tet Offensive, I was in an operation where half the troops were American and half the troops were South Vietnamese. And when we ran into North Vietnamese troops, the South Vietnamese turned around and ran, and the North Vietnamese were shooting at F-4 Phantoms with AK-47s. What's wrong with this picture? It was a moment of truth for me. If Iraqis want some kind of stability, want some kind of reasonable sort of government, then, you know, they've got to start informing on these people. They've got to start picking up AK-47s, and they've got to start fighting for their freedom. It can't be us, because, you know, no matter what we do, you know, we get kicked in the shins for it, seems to me.
Larry Korb, Robert is not the only person to draw analogies to Vietnam, and also the reason there could be more American troops sent is that the performance of Iraqi security forces has thus far been a great disappointment.
Robert's absolutely right. I recently gave a talk, and a professor there, like Robert, who had been in Vietnam, brought up Robert McNamara's book where he talked about the 11 mistakes that we made in Vietnam. I went back and looked at it, and we've made the same mistakes again. And I don't disagree, but this is something we should have thought about before we went in there. That's the problem.
Speaking of the 11 mistakes, you know, one of the mistakes in the Vietnam War was the 12-month tour of duty. My father was in World War II, and he was overseas for 3 years.
Yeah.
If this is a war, you know, why is 12 months a magic number?
Why isn't it for the duration? Yeah.
Well, there's no, again, in Vietnam, the reason that you had the 12-month tours, we decided to rely on draftees to fight that war. And the draft, as you probably remember, was very uneven. We called up basically the people who were not the children of the elite, and that was the only way you could maintain popular support. Right now, the reason that you only have the one-year tour is you have a volunteer military, and if you kept the people like World War II, you'd have a horrible retention rate when it was over. Now, I think at the bottom of this is a war of choice, not a war of necessity. Now, when you have a war of choice, you should ask all the questions that Robert said. We didn't ask them, and now we have this horrible situation that we're trying to make the best of.
Mm-hmm. Chuck Pena, again, the analogies are drawn to Vietnam, and remembering, who was it, Senator Aiken says, declare victory and leave.
Well, I think there's some good analogies here. First of all, Vietnam was thought to be part of a domino theory in Southeast Asia. Iraq was thought to be part of a domino theory for democracy in the Middle East. Vietnam became a question of we could make a decision to limit our losses and leave early on. Instead, we chose to double down our bets and put in more troops. We're at that similar decision point now inside Iraq. And I think the most important thing to remember that I think does tie the two together is that neither one was a war of national survival. Vietnam was not a question of national survival. Iraq is not a question of national survival.
Of American
national survival. And what we are left with, Larry is right, what we are left with is a series of not very good choices anymore. There is no perfect outcome. There may not even be a good outcome. We may be choosing amongst the least bad of some very bad options, but the question is whether we make those choices now and pick the least bad, or do we keep muddling along, which is what the administration appears to be doing, and then get forced with an even worse outcome some months or years down the road. Mm-hmm.
Robert, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Roy. And Roy, am I get this right, in Payon, New Mexico? Is that right?
That's Taos, New Mexico.
Taos. Somebody misspelled the first and last letters, but go ahead.
Okay. My thought is, suggestion is, that we get boots on the ground in Iraq that speak Iraqi language, mm-hmm. that speak that Arabic language. And the other thing is, I think we ought to pull our troops back out of those holy cities and pull our troops out of there and exchange them for boots that speak Arabic. And, you know, I hope these people that plan this war, I would suggest that they start reading this book, The Art of War, which was written 5,000 years ago.
By Sun Tzu, and, yes.
Yeah. I have it laying on my table here. I've been reading it. So, some comment about getting other troops.
Well, let me get a response to your first point, Roy. As a former official in the Defense Department, how easy is it to get Arabic-speaking soldiers?
Not very easy.
It's Lawrence Korb, of course.
I think all of the Arabic-speaking soldiers are probably there now. And as you know, we're so short, we've had to hire civilian contractors to interrogate the prisoners at Abu Ghraib, which creates a whole other situation. I think in an ideal world, and if hopefully we can do this, is to get troops in there from Muslim countries who could identify more with the population and would be seen less as occupiers. That certainly would help. And if the UN resolution that the president is trying to get comes out right, that certainly might help. I heard the Pakistani foreign minister yesterday being interviewed on television, and he said if there's an appropriate UN resolution, he thinks that they may be able to contribute troops. Well, they're Muslims, and that certainly would help.
Mm-hmm. Chuck Pena?
Yeah, but we do have a conundrum, though, in Iraq, because you know, we would like to internationalize the force, yet most of our international partners are leery of wanting to come in. Why? Because they might get shot at and bombed and killed. And I can't say that I blame them for being leery about coming into Iraq. And without internationalizing it, without getting a UN mandate, clearly none of the Muslim countries, certainly at least none of the neighboring Arab countries, are going to buy into helping the Iraqis. But most importantly, you know, what is it that the Iraqis want? I mean, we haven't really gotten Iraqi buy-in on almost anything. I mean, we've been trying to run the show from a Western perspective, assuming that there's this one-size-fits-all democracy, and instead of understanding that history, culture, geography matter in the Middle East and in the Muslim world. And so as long as we continue to try and have a have-it-our-way situation in Iraq and not listen as closely as we need to the Iraqi people, I'm afraid we're in for one sort of disaster after another inside Iraq.
Roy, you had another point?
No, that was all I wanted to say.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay, let's talk now with Christine. Christine joins us on the line from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Christine.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question or comment really is, whoever, your guest who said that we need to move out of there as soon as possible, I'm not for the war. I think, you know, once you get in it, now you're stuck. Because if we move out too quickly, then we set up a whole chaotic situation like Afghanistan, which just breeds terrorists again. So that makes us less safe. I mean, I'm from the very beginning, I thought that this was just, you know, a major mistake to, it's not a war on terror. It's just, to make us less safe, in fact. But I'd like your comment on that.
Well, Chuck Pena, you were the one who advocated that. And you heard also, just by parenthetically, Eric Westerveld saying a lot of Iraqis say, hey, don't pull out, there'll be a civil war if you guys leave.
Well, a civil war is a possibility. Certainly Iraq's going to descend into some form of chaos, and there's likely to be bloodshed. The question is whether any of that endangers U.S. national security. I would argue that it does not, as terrible and as tragic as it might be. And Iraq doesn't necessarily have to become a hotbed for al-Qaeda terrorists at any rate. I think when we leave Iraq, we tell the Iraqis, do not harbor or support al-Qaeda, otherwise we'll have to come back and do this all over again. Neither the Sunnis, the Shia, or the Kurds have any natural affinity for Al-Qaeda or reason to work with them, unless, of course, they're trying to expel a foreign occupier. I don't think it necessarily becomes the chaotic situation that we saw in Afghanistan. Even an Islamic government in Iraq is not necessarily going to be the Taliban, which played host to Al-Qaeda. It's certainly a possibility. It's not necessarily the most likely outcome. And I think the one thing that we have to hold out to the Iraqi people is the prospect that they're sitting on top of all this oil. And if they can get their internal affairs in order, if they can decide not to engage in internecine bloodletting, that everyone in the country will benefit as a result of that, and that corporations and governments will want to invest in their country if they can show the rest of the world that they're a country worth investing in.
Lawrence Korb, how long after those elections in January 2005 do you think U.S. forces should continue to stay in Iraq?
Well, I wish I could set a deadline, and I would, hope that they could leave soon. But I'm not willing to take the chance that it could descend into chaos like Christine is talking about, that you could have this civil war. And even if it doesn't become a hotbed for Al-Qaeda, I think we don't like to use this term, but we have a moral responsibility for the future of Iraq. We can't just say, well, we broke it and we don't care what happens. I think we've taken on another dimension, and we need to see it through. Some people have suggested that we give a timeline of 2 years, and that would certainly give the Iraqis time to get their act together. I never liked this June 30th deadline. I think that basically put a timeline on something that we weren't ready for. So having said that, I think Chuck is right. We can't undo it now, but I don't think you ought to put a date certain there, because if you do, I think you're taking too big a risk.
Christine, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's wind up this conversation with you two gentlemen with this email question we got from William, who lists himself as a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. Let's get a clearly defined question, goal, objective, expectations before we try to ascertain whether more troops are the answer. So both of you, is the objective clearly defined?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, and that's part of the problem. I think the administration never did clearly define the goal and what the objective is. You know, one of the great ironies of this is the person who had it most right, General Powell, unfortunately, wasn't listened to. And he developed a doctrine that he did when I worked with him in the Pentagon in consultation with my boss, Secretary Weinberger, which said, when you go in with overwhelming force, you have a clear exit strategy, and you have clear objectives. We didn't have that, and that's the problem. Now, hopefully the president will tell us that. Now, if he can't come up with any clear objectives or exit strategy, then maybe we're going to have to walk away from it. But I would hope that given where we are now, that he can do better than that.
Larry Korb, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower, Reserve Affairs, Installations, and Logistics back in the Reagan administration. Thanks very much.
Thank you for
and
having me.
Charles Pena is Director of Defense Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Thank you for coming in today as well.
Thank you.
Both of them joined us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Andy Kohut. He's director of the Pew Research Center for People and the Press, and he's on the phone with us from his office in Washington. Good to talk to you again, Andy.
Hi, Neil.
Where does American opinion stand on sending more troops?
Well, Gallup has about 25% of the American public saying we should be sending more troops, which is the same percentage, almost the same percentage, you saying we should take them all at home, take them all home right now. So those two polar extremes reflect the division in the country about what we should do with troops in Iraq. We still have a small balance of opinion saying we should keep troops there as long as it takes to have a stable government, but we have a growing number of people saying, let's get out as soon as possible. But there is some appetite among the people who think we should be there for seeing more troops in Iraq now.
Mm-hmm. So what do you read from this obvious split?
Well, the obvious split reflects the fact that things have gone badly. You know, back in January or back in 2003, as many as two-thirds in our survey were saying we got to keep troops there as long as necessary. But unrelenting bad news, a growing casualty count, and most of all, the public not having a sense where we're going in Iraq, given all of this bad news, has undermined support. It's shaken. It hasn't completely fallen through the floor, but something has to be done if the American public is going to stay with the American military effort in Iraq.
Is there a tipping point, do you think, that may decisively change public opinion?
Well, we've had a lot of potential tipping points: Fallujah, Abu Ghraib, and the Shiite insurrection. All of those things might have driven support to the opinion that we should get out to a majority point of view. It hasn't happened so far. What we do see now is, in the first time in our poll, a majority saying things are really not going very well. A majority in Gallup survey saying the war is not worth the effort. But still, we don't have the bottom falling out. So no tipping point yet, but lots of frustration and an ever smaller appetite for a smaller patience level.
One of the things that I found interesting in looking at some of the opinion surveys was differences on willingness to tolerate casualties. In other words, if people think policy is going well and that there's a reason for whatever's going on, then all right, if people are going to be killed, so be it. If they think that the policy is failing, at that point, casualties become intolerable.
Well, it's a cost-benefits thing. If people feel we're making a sacrifice for the sake of something that is going to be good for our country and good for the war on terrorism more generally, they obviously are more accepting of paying higher costs. On the other hand, if it's seen as a quagmire or seen as an operation that is going nowhere, well, then obviously these costs are seen as too high.
Is there any way to characterize demographically, and we just have about 30 or 45 seconds left with you in this segment, who's on which side?
Well, the biggest difference in who's on which side is political, Republicans and Democrats. I mean, the Democrats have a completely different view of far less support, more of a notion that these troops should come out, and Republicans take the opposite point of view. That's the big difference. And, of course, gender and race and all of the usual differences that we have when it comes to attitudes toward war.
Is Republican support eroding?
Republican support is not eroding. It's down, but it's not eroding. The issue is independent support. I mean, there is a base of support still there because many independents who are on the fence are still leaning in the direction of keeping troops in Iraq.
Andy, stay with us, if you would.
Sure.
Andy Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, joining us on the phone. He's going to stay with us when we come back from a break. We'll also be joined by Michael Duffy of Time Magazine as we look ahead to the president's speech tonight and the problems he's trying to solve. Again, our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, TOTN at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.